The art gallery has issued a statement about the bomb threats. The police have a suspect. Oh, boo. That's all. This whole useless article is just to say they have a suspect. The janitor, it says. Fat lot of good that does me. Doesn't say his name. The ethics there seem a bit dicey to me in a small city like this, though. Say his name or don't, but don't tell people who he is and then pretend you've taken the high road by not saying his name outright. She moved her face closer and closer to the newspaper as she spoke. Why would you make bomb threats to your own... Oh, actually, that does make sense, doesn't it? He probably hated his boss or another employee. Maybe he just wanted some time off. Oh, maybe he was in love with someone there and they spurned his advances. Excuse me, ladies. The barista smiled apologetically, but her co-workers were glaring from behind the counter. We're closed, I'm afraid? Mackenzie nodded. We're going. So sorry. Maud gathered the paper and folded it into quarters as she stood to leave. Well, she said to Suna, it's better than nothing. And just think, we wouldn't have known there was a suspect if it weren't for the newspaper. Okay, Maud. Suna opened the door for Mackenzie and Maud and followed them through it. Next, you're going to tell me you still use payphones, she said, motioning to the old telephone booth they passed on their way out. When I need to, Maud mumbled into the collar of her coat. Actually? Maud stopped walking in the middle of the parking lot and stomped her foot like a child who was about to throw a temper tantrum. Well, yes, Suna. Not everyone has a cell phone in their pocket. Suna shook her head. What? Payphones are fine. Have you honestly never used one before? Suna shook her head again. Mackenzie? Mackenzie's eyes widened. Well, yes. Now Suna stopped walking, too. What? People actually use those things, like other than Maud and people committing crimes? There's a comedian who has a whole thing about how criminals are the only people who use payphones. Mackenzie had that dazed look on her face that she got sometimes, a look that Suna couldn't quite figure out. Was she sad? Worried? Simply lost in thought? If Suna didn't know better, she'd think the look was a guilty one. Suna smiled at the thought of Mackenzie committing a crime. Maybe she had Mackenzie pegged all wrong. She seemed like such a quiet, polite person. Maybe it was all an act. Maybe she was exactly the kind of person who used payphones. Flower Crisis. Larry. Hello, Larry. Maud here. There is definitely something in the attic, and it sounds very large. I'm going to need you to call an exterminator, please, as soon as possible. Thank you. Hello, Larry. Maud here. Did you get my last message? I left it about 10 minutes ago. Let me know if you got it, and also when the exterminator will be here. Thank you. Larry, where are you? It's Glenda. I've been calling and calling and calling. You're all over the news. I mean, they haven't said it's you, but I know it's you, and I'm just so worried about you, Lair. Call me. Hello, Larry. Maud here. I'm sorry for calling twice in a row, but the noise just started up again, and I wanted you to hear it. Silence. Okay, so that's what we're dealing with. Please call an exterminator as soon as you can. Thank you. Larry, what's going on? Do you need me to come check on you? I know you hate it when I do that, but... I'm really worried about you. Can you please call me? Larry, it's Glenda again. Where are you? Call me. Now. Please. Hello, Larry. Maud here. I'm beginning to wonder if this is not your number anymore. If there is a better way to reach you, please do let me know as soon as possible. I am having trouble sleeping with all this racket in the attic. Oh, there it is again. Listen. Silence. Thank you. Larry sat on his couch and watched his phone buzz and buzz and buzz with each successive phone call. He wasn't ignoring phone calls because he was depressed. He was avoiding them because he felt like he was allowed. Not that this distinction would make a difference to anyone but him. It was a conscience thing. Surely you were allowed a grace period when you were going through something this big to be reclusive and socially inept. It was almost required. A week or two, or six, to sit on your couch and wallow in your misfortune, to think about how far your life was from what it was supposed to have been. You were supposed to spend this time in boxer shorts, unshaven, growing a bigger gut. So, not answering the phone? Tame, expected, allowed, and not really that different from how he normally lived his life, aside from the not answering phone calls and not leaving to go to work. The phone buzzed for the 100th time that day. He held it up to see whose number was on the screen. Glenda, again. He set it on the coffee table and watched it skitter toward the edge of the uneven surface. "I'm being investigated by the police for making bomb threats at my place of employment," he yelled at the buzzing phone. "I need time to process this, Glenda. Leave me alone for once." He grabbed the phone and stuck it under the couch cushion he was sitting on. The cop at the art gallery had asked him only a few basic questions and sent him away infinitely more confused than he thought he should be for someone who was being investigated. What was the logic there, he wondered. Maybe they figured that if he was guilty, he'd already know what had gone on, and if he wasn't, it wasn't any of his business. They told him only that he was under investigation, that they'd used call detail records and triangulation to place the cell phone used to make the bomb threats at or near his place, but that those records were not precise and they would therefore need to pull a warrant for further investigation. Larry hadn't understood any of it. Should he be worried? You didn't have to be worried if you were innocent, right? All things considered, Larry was actually doing quite well. He was going to use up his grace period and do his wallowing, and then, when his good name was restored, he would resurface and answer his phone and go back to work, just until he'd paid for the renovations to his inherited mansion, and then he'd quit. Who wanted to work for someone who believed you were the kind of person who made bomb threats? He looked around the room at the posters, the TV, the remote control on the coffee table beside an empty bowl from so long ago he couldn't remember anymore what he'd eaten out of it. He picked up the remote and pressed play. The TV blinked at him, and Nikola Sarchevich's face came into view. He'd been watching his favorite music video compilation before heading out to work the other day. This was good. He could do his wallowing to old punk videos. He dug in the couch cushion for his phone, but came up with the latest issue of Razor Cake instead. Even better. VHS tapes and magazines. He could pretend he was back in the 90s or the early 2000s. Simpler times. He flipped the magazine open to the album reviews, where some new band called Flower Crisis had a 3-column write-up and a full-color photograph splashed across the top of the page in which 4 out of 4 band members had their tongues out of their mouth for no good reason he could see. "Flower Crisis," Larry mumbled. "Terrible name." The review began with a question, which Larry hated. Reviews were for telling the audience something. Interviews were for asking the band something. At no point should the writer be asking the audience anything. "Do you long for the heady glory days of old school punk?" Larry nodded to the empty room. Dumb question. Of course he did. "Look no further than this year's breakout punk outfit, Flower Crisis. If you were into Simple Plan back in the day and missed the..." Larry frowned. "How could anyone have been into Simple Plan back in the day?" he asked no one loudly. "They didn't exist back in the day." He flipped to the next page to see who had written the offending sentence. A young man with brown hair parted neatly on one side smiled up at him with a face that clearly said, "I liked Simple Plan back in the day." "You didn't exist back in the day," Larry told the kid. He sank back into the couch. It wasn't the kid's fault. He looked like he was born well after many of the great punk rockers had already passed on. How was he supposed to know he'd missed it all? But now this baby and all the others like him would be in charge of the magazines, the show reviews, the band write-ups. Thanks to people like him, the next generation would look back at Simple Plan and think that was where it all began. They'd think punk was sticking your tongue out. It felt like a superhero origin story kind of moment. Like, future generations of music lovers needed a hero who would help them understand what had gone on before them so they could really appreciate what they had now. And he, Larry Finley, could be that hero. He had nothing else to do. He smiled at the thought of his own little picture in Razor Cake, or on a music website, at the bottom of thoughtful articles and critical reviews, dissecting and promoting the music he loved, analyzing its evolution and critiquing its existence in 2020, finding the really good new bands. He believed they were out there somewhere, and giving them to their audience, giving their audience to them. Musical matchmaking. But how did one go about getting his opinions printed and endorsed and then distributed to the masses? How did one gain favor with the editor of Razor Cake? He turned the page to the articles section. Another piece about another new band he'd never heard of. He looked at the picture. Another kid. Only, this one looked familiar. He sat up. It looked like the girl from his basement suite. The one with the dainty tattoo. He held the magazine up to catch the dim light from the bare bulb in the ceiling. It was her, for sure. He distinctly remembered the two poppies inked on the inside of her arm. Only, the name in the byline was Kate Weiss. He was sure that wasn't the name of his tenant. A pen name? He suppressed a shout of excitement. He had an in. He could talk to her and ask if she'd put in a good word for him, or, at the very least, show him how to send his work to the right place. After he sharpened his pencil and figured out how to write a music review, of course. Wallowing time was over. Larry Finley had a new lease on life. If he didn't have to go to jail at the end of all this. He looked around and realized he didn't own a laptop on which to write a music review. He realized he didn't own paper, a notebook, anything. Incredible. He would start from nothing at all. Just like Ken Casey of the Dropkick Murphys, who played his first two shows to no fans, only a few friends who were there expressly to make fun of him. I am just like Ken Casey. Larry had some shopping to do. The smell of important events. Mackenzie.
It wasn't the thought of ghosts that kept Mackenzie up late that night, though she couldn't help but think of them every time she heard a strange sound, and there were a lot of those. It was the feeling that something was about to happen. She lazed around, staring into space, because she had a feeling that even if she tried to be productive, she would just be interrupted by the thing that was going to happen anyway. It was the way the air smelled, the same way it had the night of the birthday party. Mackenzie hadn't been able to sleep that night either. She'd sat up in bed next to an open window, looking out at the nebulous outlines of the spruce trees that lined the edge of the farmyard. When it was that dark, looking out the window was like looking into a cave. The trees were like giant stalagmites. The black sky could have been stone. The air that moved her lacy curtains smelled different. Important. Back then, she hadn't known about the way the air smelled when something big was about to happen, because as far as she was concerned, nothing big had ever happened before that night. But now, a few years later, a few big things later, she knew. It was like the smell before rain, but sharper and thicker. A smell that triggered some kind of confoundingly pleasant chemical reaction in her brain, but also made her want to cry. She tried to remember if the air had smelled this way the last time she'd talked to Jared, and decided it hadn't. Which may have meant that he had never been as important as she'd once felt he was. When she met Grant, the air had smelled like sweat and French fries. They'd been in the university food court. What did that mean? He'd mentioned the exchange again at work the other night, and this time he'd asked if she wanted to go to a show there with him and some of his friends that Sunday. She should have said yes. She'd wanted to. She didn't even have a good reason to say no. and she'd taken a million years to get back to him, not because she was checking her agenda, like she'd said, but because she was trying to think of a good way to admit to him that social gatherings caused her excruciating anxiety, especially ones that happened at night. That if she was not at school or at work, she just wanted to be home, barricaded in her suite with a chair under the door handle. She stared out the kitchen window. It was high and small, but she could still see the sidewalk in front of the house, and people, when they walked past, from the waist down. Someone with baggy jeans rode by on a skateboard. Her phone rang.
Here it is.
Hello?
Mackenzie.
Her father. He said her name like it was a touchstone, like he was doing one of his grounding exercises where he looked around the room and said the names of things he was sure of.
Table, lamp, window. It made her nervous.
What's up, Dad?
Well, he said,
and there was a pause. She felt frustrated with the pause. Why hadn't he thought about what he was going to say before calling so she didn't have to sit there and listen to him pause? What, Dad?
Sorry, I'm trying to think of how to say this.
You should have thought of that before you called, Mackenzie said. She wrinkled her nose. She sounded like Suna, or even Maud. I'm sorry, she said.
No, he said. I don't blame you. I'll get right to it. I just got some news and called you without stopping to think.
He cleared his throat.
So, the police just called. Oh, your mom's here, too, on the other phone.
Hi, Mackenzie's mom said. How are you, baby? Mackenzie dragged a finger across her forehead to her temple, pulling the skin taut. I don't know how I am, Mom. I have a feeling that however I am, I'm going to be different after you say whatever you're going to say. How about you tell me how I am? Her father cut in again.
I'm sorry, Mackenzie. We're sorry. I'll get you up to speed. The police just called, and they're reopening the case.
Mackenzie had wondered if this would be the thing. She just hadn't thought it would happen so soon. Why? She asked. Her voice was so soft she could barely hear it over the sound of her heartbeat. She looked down at herself, and it was like she'd floated right out of her own body and was looking at someone else's. It seemed tenuous, like a stilt house, like a strong enough gust of wind could blow it over. Why? She asked again. There was a pause, and she realized that someone had been talking and she had interrupted. Sorry, she said. I think the connection is bad. Can you start over one more time? Her voice sounded strange. She didn't feel frantic, but she sounded frantic. She sounded like she was about to cry, even though there was nothing to cry about.
You okay, Mac?
Her father sounded concerned.
Do you need a minute? I know this is very overwhelming. Your mother and I feel exactly the same way. It's okay, Mackenzie. This is a very normal reaction to stress.
Mackenzie's father had spent a lot of time with his therapist after their familial tragedy. Now, whenever anyone around him reacted to anything, he switched into therapist mode and began to recite the things he'd learned there like he was in a school play. And this was one of his favorite therapy-isms.
This is a very normal reaction to stress.
He said it about every single thing Mackenzie had done since that summer. She could have snapped and gone on a killing rampage, and she pictured him in the courtroom, tenting his hands and furrowing his brows at the judge and saying,
"To be fair, Your Honor, this is a very normal reaction to stress."
Her mother said he liked feeling helpful. She said she and Mackenzie should let him feel helpful, even if he wasn't. I'm good, said Mackenzie, though she was very far from good. She was far from bad, too. She was so far from everything, she might as well have been sitting on another Earth in another galaxy, listening to someone tell her about the inconsequential goings-on over on this one. Why? Why are they reopening the case? I thought they said they couldn't do anything more. This time, her voice sounded strained and angry, like someone had their hands around her throat. But she didn't feel angry.
I started this. This was what I wanted. They said they have new evidence.
His voice broke on the first word, but he pushed through. Mackenzie recognized this version of his voice because it was the only tone he'd used for months after that awful night.
Did they say what it was? The new evidence?
Well,
he said carefully. Then he paused again, and she wasn't sure, but she thought she heard him mumbling under his breath.
Chair, carpet, clock. They're not telling us much at this point, which...
He cleared his throat for a while.
Shoes, shirt, belt.
Mackenzie felt vaguely sorry for him. In the same abstract way, she'd felt sorry for that jello-y, uninhabited body beneath her a moment earlier.
They received an anonymous tip, and they'll update us as soon as they can. And then we will absolutely call you, okay? The second we know anything.
Mackenzie said okay and goodbye, and she hung up the phone, and then warmed up a frozen pizza and ate the whole thing by herself. It was, she figured, a very normal reaction to stress.
Attic Ghosts. Suna.
Suna didn't sleep well that night either. When the women arrived home from Paper Cup, she said goodnight, slipped into her suite, and slid down against her door, her knees crackling like tissue paper, like she was 1,000 years old instead of 34. The old house was too quiet. The street was too quiet. The city was too quiet. There was nothing to drown out her thoughts. Toronto had been a good distraction. It was loud, belligerent, like Maud. It didn't wait for your thoughts to settle before it interrupted you, yelled at you, made you feel like you were losing your mind. But at least you had a good, extraneous reason to lose your mind. Suna's last Toronto apartment had paper-thin walls, and the couple next door fought all the time. Someone in the complex had loud parties on weeknights, and someone else kept their television blaring. Toronto allowed a person to feel superior and self-righteous. I'm trying to sleep. I have a job. I have people in my life with whom I have civil indoor voice conversations. Regina was like Mackenzie. It smiled at you politely, waiting for you to say something. It never interrupted. It let you explore every single what-if and mull over every worst-case scenario and even venture into self-loathing, only interjecting with a faraway siren or distant screeching tire here and there. It forced you to be the noisy one and left no room for you to be upset with anyone other than yourself. It was so polite you caught yourself wishing it would be rude. Suna had complained about the midnight furniture moving the night before, but she almost wanted it now. She wished Maud were the type to bang pots and pans as she prepared a meal, had a hard-of-hearing husband who turned his television up too loud, had noisy little grandchildren running around. For the first time, it dawned on her that Maud probably wished for some of these same things. She would have felt sorry for Maud had she not felt so sorry for herself. It was just too much like looking into her future. Someday she, too, would be 60 or 70, whatever, and living in a house with two young losers, selling her furniture because it made her sad, and freaking out on strangers in coffee shops for having wives. She would be angry and rude, and she wouldn't brush her hair anymore. She went to the bathroom and examined her face in the mirror as she washed her hands. Did this face have the potential to look like Maud's? She frowned as severely as she could and pinched her lips together. Yes, she could see some Maud in there. When she unpuckered, the lines stayed. Faint, shallow ditches, surrounded by several finer ones that had appeared over the past couple of years, scratched into her face by some invisible hand while she slept. She thought of a friend back in Toronto who'd mentioned one day that she'd started going in for some non-surgical tweaks. She'd called them injectables. She'd said, they can change the shape of your nose, create symmetry, give your jaw more definition, that kind of thing. A few months later, the friend was saving her money again for just a little more work. And then came the second bank account, a secret from her husband, to pay for Botox treatments every 4 months and a series of plastic surgeries that were obvious but never acknowledged. Suna had thought her friend was being silly. They'd been, what, 27 at the time? What did anyone need a perfectly symmetrical face for? Why would someone pay thousands of dollars to have a differently shaped nose?
And why, after all that, couldn't her friend look in the mirror at that million-dollar person she'd designed and paid for without sighing and poking and grimacing? Extreme vanity, Suna had thought. But now, she wished she could apologize to her friend for her judgment, even if that friend had been unaware of it. Suna had been vain, too. She'd just not yet experienced dissatisfaction. Besides, maybe it wasn't vanity at all. Maybe it was actually something closer to fear. Not fear of being ugly, but of mattering less than someone who was beautiful, or successful, or, she thought of Mackenzie, good. She wandered back into the living room and sat on the couch. She opened Instagram. Ex-friends smiled from the screen. Their kids were having birthdays and going to school. They were having endless, almost frantic, professional family photo shoots, like they were afraid that one of them was going to die or be disfigured beyond recognition at any moment. Brett had been one of the only other women in Suna's small university friend group whose ultimate goal wasn't to be a wife and mother. The rest of them, in recent years, had formed couples, become families, amassed little armies of whiny, constantly ill children, and banded together in solidarity. The women who had once been so reckless and fun now called each other Mama in the same soothing, patronizing voice they used with their children. They got together before the sacred afternoon nap, during the morning hours while Suna was at work. She was left out of their jokes and wasn't invited to the kids' birthday parties. And she was never sure if she should invite her friends to hang out with her in the evenings because they were always talking about how tired they were. If she mentioned a promotion or told a funny story about a night out, she was most often met with blank stares or, worse, pity. Looks that clearly said, "Isn't it sad that this is what makes you happy?" And then they'd talk about what their 2-year-old had accomplished in the bathroom that week and expect her not to make the same face back at them. Still, none of these flawless photos sparked jealousy in her, even though she knew that at her age, with her relationship status, they had the potential to, were basically designed to. The kids, she knew, were messy and prone to vomiting on airplanes and in cars and talking too much and ruining plans and never sleeping. She hesitated for a moment, then navigated to a page she knew would make her jealous. Brett Zales Chuck, she typed, and the familiar page loaded onto her screen. This had begun as a once or twice a month thing, checking in to see what Brett was doing, what people were saying about her. Just out of curiosity, Suna told herself. What has she accomplished? Who are her friends now? Where is she traveling? Now, Suna automatically navigated to Brett's page every single time she went online. Wisdom said this behavior was unhealthy. But did wisdom actually stop anyone from doing anything? No. People stopped doing stuff when they wanted to. Suna touched the pink circle at the top of the page, and Brett's face materialized. Brett paused before speaking to tuck a glossy strand of hair behind a dainty ear adorned with tiny gold hoops and diamonds the size of pinpricks. In that moment, Brett looked so impressed with herself, so fond of the face she saw in her screen, that Suna felt vaguely voyeuristic, as though she were intruding on something romantic. She checked the background to see if there were any clues to Brett's current location. Regina? But there was nothing to give it away. Brett didn't use Instagram for vignettes of her day-to-day life the way other people did. These were pep talks, advice, encouragement, dressed up as things Brett was learning right alongside her audience so that people would call her generous and humble instead of a know-it-all. "Hey, guys," Brett said, flashing a smile and cutely tilting her head. "I just wanted to pop in and say a word of encouragement. I know it's a super busy season. I know we're all running around like chickens with our heads cut off. But I wanted to remind you that the work you're doing is not wasted because nothing..." Here, she slowed down so even the pauses between her words were like whole sentences. "Is ever wasted." She looked off screen for a brief second, like she was gathering her thoughts, playing with the gold chain around her neck, and then zeroed back in on her reflection. "And I just wanted to say that no matter where you are or who you are or what you're working toward, you're essential, babe."
Suna snorted and threw the phone on the couch, hard, knowing the cushions would soften its landing. Brett's voice floated up, unaware of her angst, unaware of her period. The world needs your unique talents, your drive, your story. Suna was not an irrational person, given to fits of anger or violence. She was easily irritated, and yes, at times, snippy. But it was not like her to, say, throw a phone through a window. That's how she knew the Brett thing was really getting to her. It felt good in the moment, exceptionally good, and then immediately and disproportionately terrible. She regretted it the second her phone hit the glass, maybe even the second before. She stared with horror at the hole in the window. She thought of her dad then. Or, more accurately, she thought of her mom talking about her dad to her Aunt Denise. "He doesn't think about us," her mom had said, speaking as though her 7-year-old daughter were not sitting right there at the kitchen table staring at her. "He just thinks about the things he wants and he goes and gets them." Actually, no, that's not right. He doesn't think about them either. He just goes and gets. He's a go-getter. Her mom had laughed and laughed and laughed, but Suna had understood that she was angry. And for years after that, she thought it was a bad thing to be a go-getter. "You almost can't blame him," her mom had continued. "I don't believe he actually has any control over his actions. I'm always afraid Suna's going to take after him. She's already so much like him." She'd glanced at her daughter, snapping her fingers and pointing to indicate that Suna needed to take her fingers out of her mouth. Of course, Suna's mom didn't really mean you couldn't blame him. She blamed him all the time, for everything. But that little snippet of conversation stored itself away in a corner of Suna's brain, and she heard it play like a recording when she did impulsive things. She didn't have any control over her actions. You almost couldn't blame her. It was already getting dark and cold outside. The air was wet. She closed the front door behind her and creaked across the porch, making her way down the stairs and around the side of the old building. An old man passing by on the sidewalk nodded in her direction and she mumbled a greeting. He went slowly, choosing carefully where every step would land, like an insect making its way across a gravel road. She waited until he was out of sight before she got down on her hands and knees to feel around in the damp grass. As she made her way around the shadowy yard, Suna began to second-guess her decision to quit going to Paper Cup. Maybe she wasn't okay after all. You didn't throw expensive things through expensive windows if you were okay. If you were okay, you thought about your actions, and you only followed through on the right ones. "You almost can't blame her," she heard her mother say from way off in the past. "She's just like her dad." Suna found her phone in a bush, just outside the broken window, miraculously undamaged. She used packing tape left over from her move to temporarily patch the glass. She'd call Larry in the morning. "For now, a book," she thought as she sat once more in her living room. She swung an arm over the back of the couch, reaching for the tote bag containing her latest collection of library books, but her hand came up empty. She peered over at the vacant space on the floor. Was she losing her mind? Or... no, she'd forgotten the tote bag at Paper Cup on her last visit. She'd have to go back and pick it up. At least she had an excuse. She could tell herself, and Mackenzie and Maud, that she wasn't really going back because of Brett, that she was still okay. She just didn't want to pay for all those library books. Suna woke up around midnight to a loud scraping noise. The sound of something tremendous being dragged across the floor above her. It began directly above her head and moved toward the kitchen. There was a slight pause, and then it started up again, coming back toward her. Another slight pause, more scraping. "Maud!" she shouted. The scraping continued. She stormed into the kitchen and grabbed the broom from its nook between the fridge and the wall. She climbed onto the couch and began to slam the broom into the ceiling. She was mostly a live-and-let-live person, but she'd done this a few times in her Toronto apartment when the man who lived above her had his friends over to watch football games. It was harder to live-and-let-live for some reason when someone's very existence set your teeth on edge. The scraping continued. "Fine!" Suna shouted at the ceiling. "I'm coming up!" She stomped to the vestibule and tried Maud's door. Locked. She knocked with the side of her fist. "Maud!" she yelled, and banged again. Finally, she heard footsteps on the stairs and the sound of a chain being removed from the back of the door. The door cracked open, and Maud peered out suspiciously.
"What?" she spat. "What could you possibly want at this time of night, you stupid girl?"
Suna crossed her arms, sputtering.
"Excuse me? At this time of night? At this time of night, what could I want? Excuse me, Maud!"
From above them, the scraping sound took up again, the familiar grinding noise making its slow trip from one end of the house to the other. Suna glanced up, but Maud kept her eyes on the younger woman, her sharp chin tipped up. Suna's skin prickled, and the inside of her head felt cold. She gulped.
I...
She looked back at Maud to confirm that she was indeed standing in front of her.
"I told you," said Maud, her voice flat and matter-of-fact. "We have ghosts, and I don't think they like you."
She slammed the door in Suna's face, and Suna heard her feet on the steps again, angry and slow and deliberate. Suna went back to her apartment, but she couldn't fall asleep even after the noises above her had stopped. She couldn't stop thinking about everything. About Brett, about Maud, about the ghosts, the friend in Toronto with the plastic surgery. In the dark, Suna touched the furrows in her forehead, the craters left by acne, the swell in the middle of her nose that should have been a cute little indent. She couldn't shake the idea that she somehow mattered less than she had even a year ago, that she would just keep on mattering less and less until she no longer mattered at all. She would end up as much a ghost as the ones living in the attic of this old house. Go to sleep. They're quiet. They. She'd laugh at herself for being stupid if she wasn't so scared. Detective Maud. Suna. Mackenzie looked surprised. Maud looked furious. They weren't happy to see her, but Suna didn't care. "Can I get a ride, Mac?"
"Her name isn't Mac," said Maud. "She's not a middle-aged truck driver."
"I didn't say, can I get a ride, middle-aged truck driver," said Suna. "I said, can I get a ride, Mac?"
If Mackenzie had an opinion about her nickname, she didn't show it. She didn't appear to be paying any attention at all. She still looked surprised. But Suna was beginning to wonder if the surprised look had been there before her arrival and if it wasn't meant for her or caused by her after all.
"So, can I?"
Suna said again, irritated at having to ask twice. She watched Mackenzie's eyes focus. The girl's head began to move up and down with clear effort. She wasn't surprised, Suna realized. She was stunned. She looked like she'd been shot, or witnessed somebody else being shot, or been told she was pregnant with 10 babies all at once.
"Yep, hop in."
Mackenzie exhaled the words.
"Hop in, Soons,"
said Maud in a screechy bird voice that seemed to wake Mackenzie up. The three stood on the sidewalk in front of the house they lived in, and the trees ruffled above their heads. Maud moved to the car and began to peck at the window with a bony fist.
"Okay, let's go. Mackenzie, let us in."
Tap, 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 tap. Suna felt as irritated as if those knuckles were meeting the bone of her skull. Mackenzie unlocked the doors, walking slowly to the driver's side like she was wading through knee-high water. She dropped her keys twice, and each time she stooped to retrieve them, she paused, contemplating them as though she wasn't sure they were worth bending over for. The drive to Paper Cup was silent. Suna was irked that no one had asked why she'd come back after giving that big speech about how much she didn't care if she received an apology from Brett. The truth was that she did care. A lot. That was allowed, wasn't it? She could care about something and then not care about it. Could be angry and then sad and then neutral. Okay and then not okay. Could throw things in the privacy of her own living room and tear the pictures of Brett out of her yearbooks and cry. And then go to work and feel very indifferent to the whole thing. And maybe even remember something that she and Brett had done together that made her smile. That was the truth,
whether Maud and Mackenzie understood or not. Whoever felt only one way about something? Mackenzie parked the car twice. It was crooked on the first attempt, and Maud announced that she wouldn't get out until it was corrected. When they'd come to a complete stop the second time, Maud peered out her window at the yellow lines painted on the ground.
"Well, it's better, but it's still crooked."
Mackenzie was clutching the steering wheel so hard that her knuckles were white. "Just get out, Maud," said Suna. "It's fine."
"Fine for us," chirped Maud. "Less fine for the cars who want to park around us."
"If only you showed that kind of consideration for people trying to exist around you," said Suna. Suna asked at the counter if a tote bag full of library books had been recovered, but the barista shook her head.
"Leave your number and I can call you if something turns up."
Suna sighed, calculating her overdue fines in her head. "Okay," she said. They sat at their usual table with their usual drinks. For all Maud's righteous indignation at not being asked for her drink order each and every time, she never changed it. Maud spread her latest newspaper on the table, glancing obnoxiously at Suna as she smoothed the middle so it would lie flat.
"Does it feel, to anyone else, like this whole bomb thing is just dragging on for entirely too long? Why doesn't that guy just blow up the place? Or why don't the police arrest him? What are they waiting for?"
Suna was tired of the bomb threat conversation. It was all anyone wanted to talk about at work, when work wasn't canceled because of bomb threats. "I don't know if anyone noticed, but I'm, you know, here." Mackenzie stared at her blankly, and Suna felt unnerved. She thought she had Mackenzie figured out. Mackenzie was the nice one, unless you gave her a good reason not to be. Mackenzie was supposed to smile and be interested and ask questions and appear to enjoy the answers. She was supposed to say things meant to make you feel good even if they were untrue. And she was supposed to grab the wheel and swerve the conversation away from Rex without making you feel like she was, in fact, grabbing the wheel. She was what Suna had always thought a good mom was supposed to be like.
"Good for you. Do you want a medal?" Maud said.
"I just mean," Suna had to avoid looking directly at Maud, "that I said I wasn't coming back, but here I am." There was a long silence. Mackenzie was drawing figure eights in her coffee with a plastic stir stick. Maud leaned forward. She was jiggling her foot on the floor so the table shook as she put her weight on it.
"Yay," she said. "Yahoo! I'm so glad you could join us. Yippee! Alert the press, Mackenzie. Oh, wait, I forgot. You girls don't believe in newspapers."
"Never mind," said Suna. "You know what? Maybe I'll go sit at a different table today." She didn't move, though. She was still waiting for Mackenzie to try to stop her, but Mackenzie just continued to drag the stir stick through her coffee in slow circles. "What's wrong with you today?" Suna's voice was shrill, louder than she'd meant it to be. Mackenzie's head snapped up. She wasn't wearing her usual black eyeliner, but there were dark smudges and black flakes beneath her eyes from yesterday's makeup.
"Sorry, that came out wrong. I mean, what's wrong? Something seems wrong, that's all. You're not happy."
"I got a weird phone call last night," said Mackenzie dully.
"From who?"
Maud asked.
"My dad."
"What was weird about it?"
Maud asked, her chin moving forward like a chicken pecking at grain.
"Wow, Maud," said Suna. "All you need is a little room with a two-way mirror and a light to shine in her face."
"So you're allowed to ask her questions and I'm not?"
Suna rolled her eyes.
"It seems to me," said Maud, "that there are a bunch of things you're allowed to do that I'm not. I find it hypocritical."
"I asked how she was. You're interrogating her like she's done something wrong."
Mackenzie shook her head.
"It's fine. It's fine. I..."
She let her head loll back and she examined the ceiling for a moment. Then she sat up decisively.
"There's someone else that I've been thinking could have written the letter. Besides Jared, I mean."
"And they called you last night."
Maud's face was impossible to read. She was either angry or excited. "Her dad called her last night," said Suna. "She just said that." Maud sucked her lips into her mouth.
"Yeah, my dad called to say that they're..."
She looked down at her hands.
reopening my sister's missing person case.
Suna had been lifting her coffee cup to her lips, but her hand froze in the air. Maud blinked.
Your sister is missing. Yep. Has been for...
Mackenzie paused.
6 years now? Name's Kate. She disappeared from her bedroom one night. On my birthday, actually. She ghosted too?
Asked Maud.
Yeah, I guess so. Though that makes it sound like she disappeared on purpose.
Wow, said Suna. They don't think she ran away?
They don't think anything anymore, said Mackenzie. The police investigated it as a missing person case at first. My mom felt like they weren't taking it seriously. My family, knew she wouldn't run away. Or we knew it at first. But then I think my dad hoped she'd run away because that was better than the other things that could have gone down. He wanted to believe she was in control of whatever happened to her, if that makes sense. And he convinced himself that they'd had a weird exchange the day before and that she'd run away because of him. And then...
Mackenzie stopped talking abruptly and began picking at a hangnail.
Yeah, she said finally. That's all.
Wow, said Suna again, aware that wow was wholly inadequate. But you must think she ran away, too, if you think she wrote you this letter. You think she's coming home.
She's not, of course, said Maud.
Maud!
Suna glared at her, and Maud shrugged. What? It was 6 years ago.
Stranger things have happened.
To whom, Suna?
Mackenzie cleared her throat quietly. She took the lid off her coffee cup and put it back on. She smiled at a woman walking past, toddler on hip, coffee in hand. When her eyes focused again on Suna, they were clear, and she almost looked as though she'd forgotten what they were talking about, except for a funny rash-like redness on the tops of her cheeks.
Well, she said carefully, that was why my dad called last night, to let me know they've reopened the investigation. They got a phone call from someone with an anonymous tip. And you're upset? Shouldn't you be happy?
Maud was relentless. Mackenzie seemed to be fighting back tears now. Suna could tell there was more, but she felt guilty enough for forcing Mackenzie to say anything at all. She hoped Maud would leave it alone. But it was not in Maud's nature to leave things alone.
Oh, I see, said Maud. You think it's going to be another runaround from the police and that you'll get your hopes up again and they won't find anything?
Maud leaned back in her chair and studied Mackenzie, who was still not responding, then brought both hands down hard on the table with an incredible crash. The man at the next table jumped and knocked his coffee over.
I've got an idea, she cried, as he hurried past, headed for the napkin dispenser, glowering at the back of her head like he wanted to pluck it from her shoulders and crush it like a pop can. Let's solve it.
What? Mackenzie was flustered. She looked to Suna for clarification, or maybe help.
Who knows how long we'll be sitting here waiting every afternoon? We have nothing to do but listen to Suna squawk at everyone about how they're doing everything wrong.
Suna's mouth dropped open.
Let's solve the mystery! Before the police!
Maud's eyes were wide, and she smiled with all her teeth. She looked terrifying.
Mackenzie, you're the sister of the victim. That means you know all of the clues, all of the, you know, circumstantial evidence. We could interview you, and you could bring us, her diary, her stuff. Clues!
Maud hit the table over and over, like she was a contestant on a game show hitting a buzzer. The man who had spilled his coffee paused mid-cleanup to utter something uncouth in their general direction. Mackenzie appeared to have frozen into a chunk of granite.
Easy there, Sherlock, said Suna softly.
She was trying to figure out the expression on Mackenzie's face.
I prefer Hercule, said Maud.
Who?
Poirot, said Maud, touching her upper lip in a gesture Suna didn't understand.
Mackenzie shook her head.
My sister, she said, speaking from the bottom of her register, is not entertainment either. Just like your fiancé who dumped you at the altar? Just like...
She stopped and shook her head again. Like she had wanted to be angry but was too depressed.
I have work to do.
She pulled her laptop out of her backpack and cried unsubtly at the screen for the rest of the afternoon. When Suna arrived at the house that night, she was exhausted. She had been awake since 4:30 and had not slept well before that. She had spent so much emotional energy simply being in the same room as Maud all day that all she wanted to do was sleep. She staggered into her suite without turning the light on, preferring the soft glow of the streetlight just outside the window. It shone around the edges of the packing tape and the surrounding cracks in the glass, creating the body and legs of a large translucent spider. Her foot met something soft, but with a little give, and she pitched forward onto the floor. She rolled over and sat up, checking to see what had tripped her. And there, in the middle of the floor, where she could not possibly have missed it before, was her bag of library books. Old friends, new suspects. Larry.
Hello, Larry. Maud here. I figured it out. The noise. I think you have a tree branch scraping the roof of your house. I'm fairly confident. Oh, oops.
Silence.
Sorry, Larry. Janet needed my help there for a minute. Please call me back at your earliest convenience, and I will advise you as to what I think should be done. Larry.
Maud here.
Hi. I'm not sure what recourse I have if the landlord refuses to return my calls. I suppose I could climb onto the roof and chop this branch off of its stupid tree myself, but I presume that it would be awful for you if I were to fall. You'd have to clean me up, wouldn't you? And I wouldn't want to be that kind of hassle. Please call me back or I will... go. I will... Larry.
Hi.
Are you dead? Call me back.
Silence.
Maud here.
Larry knew he was being a terrible landlord, but he was pretty sure she wanted him to do something about the ghosts, and he didn't know how to tell her that there were ghosts in the first place, and that he could do nothing about them in the second place, and that if she had a problem with ghosts, which most people did, and who could blame them, she would have to move. But she was persistent, if nothing else. And he was beginning to wonder if she literally was nothing but persistent, if she did nothing else with her free time but persist, specifically with him. And, eventually, she wore him down. He had been sitting at his kitchen table, listening to his favorite CDs and tapes, watching his favorite videos and recorded live shows, even the local bands only people from Regina had heard of, and writing practice reviews. It was harder than he had thought it would be, but it was fun. He had purchased a laptop and a thesaurus. You could only describe someone's voice as being raw once, and then you couldn't use raw to also describe the production and the guitar tone. He had the sound cranked all the way up so he could catch all the words, all the background noise, every detail. He'd never listened to music this way before, so critically. It was like hearing it all for the first time. But the phone calls kept pulling him out of his writing zone. He no longer felt like he should completely ignore them. After all, what if one of these times it was the police? Finally, he put Maud on speakerphone and set her in front of him on the table, resting his chin in the crook of his arm and mumbling a reluctant, "Hello?"
"Larry!" Maud clucked. "I was beginning to wonder if you were dead."
"I know," he said, feeling more assertive than usual. "You said so in your last message. The 15th one you've left today."
"I feel as though you want me to feel bad for calling you 15 times when I feel like you should feel bad for not answering 15 times.
Larry nodded, ashamed.
"Larry, are you still there?"
"Yes," he said. "You're right. I'm sorry."
She didn't acknowledge his apology.
"Larry, I was calling about those noises."
"Oh, hey, Maud, before you go any further, I had something I needed to ask you."
Anything to avoid talking about those noises.
Yes?
So, you know Mackenzie, who lives in the basement? I mean, do you know her? Have you met her?
The woman took the bait eagerly, which surprised him. Yes, I do. What about her?
Do you know, is she like a journalist or something?
A journalist?
Or, you know, does she write, like, articles in newspapers and magazines?
Maud sounded disappointed now and more than a little impatient.
I don't know, Larry. Why's that?
It's not important. I just saw a picture of her in one of my magazines. Or, you know, I thought I did. But this girl's name was Kate Weiss, the one in the magazine, so probably wasn't her. Though it could be a pen name. I just had some questions for her about...
You say the girl's name was Kate, Larry? Kate? Kate what again?
Weiss?
Are you sure?
Yes?
Hmm. Thanks, Larry. I have to go.
Her voice moved away.
Janet, stop that!
And abruptly cut off. She'd hung up. Huh. He thought he'd have to work a lot harder to get out of that phone call.
Back to work.
He was taking a leisurely spin through his Bouncing Souls discography when he realized that the slightly off-time drumbeat was actually a fist on his door.
Glenda?
Most likely. He hadn't even listened to the last few messages she'd left yet. He'd been completely consumed by his new passion. He turned the music off and opened the door, expecting the disapproving face of his sister. But there were two disapproving faces. And neither belonged to Glenda. Police officers. He hoped they hadn't been waiting there for long. He hoped they weren't here to cart him off to prison. Had they obtained their warrant?
Hi, Larry squeaked. May I help you?
Larry Finley?
Asked the taller of the officers. He nodded.
Did a double take. Shelby?
Yep.
The officer grinned at her partner.
We went to high school together. Campbell.
Oh, okay,
said her partner, unimpressed.
Hi, Larry.
Larry nodded.
Hey, you're probably not here to invite me to the class reunion.
Shelby laughed.
No, I'm not.
Should I have a lawyer?
The thought had not occurred to him before this minute. Shelby might not have heard him.
We just have a few questions to ask you, Larry.
Larry nodded.
But should I have a lawyer?
She shrugged.
Don't see why you'd need one.
I mean, isn't that why you're here? Aren't I a suspect?
As soon as he said it, he wished he hadn't. What a dumb thing to say to a cop, even if the cop had been your friend 25 years ago.
I just mean, not that I should be a suspect. I mean, I didn't do anything wrong. But they fired me at the art gallery and, well, they didn't fire me, but...
Shelby laughed again.
It's okay, Larry. You'll be pleased to know you've been cleared. Your boss will probably be in touch with you soon. And on a personal note, I'm sorry that any accusations made it into the paper. That shouldn't have happened. However, we've had some very recent developments and you're no longer a person of interest. We had determined that one of the threatening calls came from your property on Montreal Street.
Oh,
Larry exclaimed, wishing they'd mentioned that part earlier. But I don't live there.
We know, now, said Shelby. We weren't aware when we began the investigation that the property was being rented out, and we apologize for the inconvenience.
Larry felt so relieved he was almost dizzy.
It was a little more than an inconvenience, wasn't it? Well, thanks for coming by to tell me I'm not a person of interest. Not that I don't sometimes wish I were a person of interest.
He grinned.
Joking, he said, just in case they didn't get it. Like I wish I were an interesting person.
Shelby smiled amiably. She'd always been so kind, even back in high school. But her partner cut in.
We actually dropped by to ask you a few questions, Mr. Finley, she said. About someone else.
Benjamin? He shouldn't have said that either. It was like a talent, how many wrong things he could say in a single conversation.
No, said Shelby.
How much do you know about the three renters in your Montreal street house?
Maud does some unappreciated sleuthing. Suna.
At first, the sound was a tapping, so quiet that Suna thought it was the radiator or some kid outside bouncing a ball on the sidewalk. Then it became a knock. And before she could make it across the room, it was a full-on pounding, which made her reconsider answering it at all. She peered through the peephole, and there was Maud, hands jammed into her coat pockets, shoulders up, a giant cloth grocery bag slung over her shoulder, and a ferocious look on her face. Suna had just come home from work. She wanted to take a nap before they went to the coffee shop. More importantly, she didn't want to spend more time talking to Maud than necessary. She began to tiptoe away from the door.
Suna, I know you're in there. I heard you singing. I saw you get home a few minutes ago.
A pause. More knocking. More squawking.
I heard the toilet flush and the sink run. Suna!
Suna could pretend she had just left, that Maud had indeed heard all these things, but that she was already gone again. She had no car to give her away. She kept tiptoeing.
I can hear the floor creaking. I can hear you sneaking away from the door, Suna.
I'm coming, Maud. Calm down.
Suna took her time opening the door. Hello, Suna, said Maud solemnly. She looked like the Grim Reaper.
Hey, Maud.
Maud pursed her lips.
May I come in? Well, I'm kind of in a hurry.
No, you're not.
Suna frowned. How would you know if I'm in a hurry or not?
Maud moved into the suite, drifting forward almost imperceptibly, like a spirit. You just got home from work, and you don't have any friends, and we don't leave for Paper Cup for at least an hour. So where in the world would you be going in a hurry?
How would you know if I had friends?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe because I live in the same building as you?